Production support from the American Society of Plant Biologists. Today's program was prepared by Sue Ann Zollinger with help from Eric Knox in biology. I'm Don Glass.
Now to sports. Rangers forward Sean Avery is in a New York hospital where he's being treated for a lacerated spleen suffered in last night's playoff loss to visiting Pittsburgh. The Rangers say Avery will be sidelined for the remainder of the season but is expected to make a full recovery. The Penguins lead the best-of-seven series 3-0. There were early afternoon starts at three major league stadiums today. The American opened play with Minnesota hosting the Chicago White Sox, while the National League has Pittsburgh at the New York Mets and Cincinnati at St. Louis. Let's look at the scores now. In the bottom of the eighth, the Twins were leading the Sox 4-3. Then in the National League, in the bottom of the fifth, Pittsburgh leading the Mets 8-0. And in the bottom of the seventh, the Cards lead Cincinnati 5-2. Ryan Dempster still hasn't lost in 2008, and tonight he'll try to help the Cubs avoid their first three-game losing streak of the season when they continue a series with the Milwaukee Brewers at Wrigley Field. Chicago fell to Milwaukee last night, 10-7. That's sports.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Architects, dedicated to defining spaces, creating places, and enhancing communities across the Midwest. On the web at ratioarchitects.com.
We have 100 days to go before the Chinese Olympics begins, and Beijing is counting every day. You would be too if you had promised to make over your city, your whole city, in time for the Games. Among other things, officials promised that the Games would be tobacco-free, but a total ban is a stretch in a country that is the largest producer and consumer of tobacco. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Beijing.
At a recent press conference, government officials admitted that the new rules were a temporary solution and that it was not realistic to stamp out smoking in many public places. Li Lingyan is deputy director of Beijing's legal affairs office. It's not yet possible to completely ban smoking in places such as restaurants and cyber cafes, she says. This goes for parks, amusement parks, and bus and train stations as well. Beijing restaurateurs recently complained that an outright ban would hurt their business. The government relented, and the new rules simply require restaurants to designate non-smoking seats. Michael Ma is the assistant general manager of a 460-seat restaurant in Beijing's Yutan Park. He says two-thirds of the seats are reserved for smokers. We're planning to gradually expand our non-smoking area, he says. But it would be difficult to entirely ban smoking from the restaurant in one go. After all, everyone knows the old Chinese saying, a smoke after a meal makes you feel like an immortal. They may feel immortal, but in fact, a million Chinese die each year from smoking, according to the National Health Ministry. China has about 350 million smokers and 540 million passive smokers who inhale secondhand smoke. But the administration of President Hu Jintao is trying to make tobacco control an important part of its public health policy. 2 years ago, China signed an international treaty called the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. That gives China until 2011 to ban smoking outright in all public areas and on all public transportation. Sun Xianli is deputy director of Beijing's Patriotic Health Campaign Committee, which is in charge of enforcing the ban locally. He notes that this is the first Olympics to be held since the convention came into effect.
A completely tobacco-free Olympics includes rejecting tobacco advertising and sponsorship from tobacco companies. And more importantly, it means a smoke-free environment in competition areas during the Olympic Games.
Sun says Beijing will deploy tobacco inspectors in Olympic venues to enforce the rules. He said the inspectors will try to set a good example for others.
In principle, the inspectors should not be smokers, and they should at least abide by the regulations themselves and not smoke in places that ban smoking.
Sun says the government will also have to beef up its penalties for violating the rules. The current fine is less than $1.50, which is the equivalent of about three packs of cigarettes here. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
It's 2:45 Central Time. Coming up this afternoon at 3, it's The World from PRI. On the program today, an Iraqi success story. The Kurds in Iraq's north have a working economy, and they're moving toward democracy. Their biggest fear is that the U.S. will leave and leave too soon. The rise of Kurdistan, that story in the day's news, coming up today on The World at 3 o'clock Central Time here on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. It's 2:46. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. In this portion of the program, we continue our occasional series of interviews with people who are making a difference, leading us to better lives in stronger communities. My guest this afternoon is William Dean, a graduate of Harvard and Columbia Law College. He has been involved in many civic activities in New York City. Currently, he is the executive director of the Volunteers of Legal Service. The organization works to increase pro bono civil legal services to New York City's poor. In addition to that work, as a board member of the Correctional Association of New York, William Dean is involved in prison reform. He joins me this afternoon to talk about the Volunteers of Legal Service, or VOLS. Mr. Dean, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Would you tell us about the people that the Volunteers assists?
Well, our whole focus is on poor people who live in New York City, and New York City is a place of immense wealth and thriving culture, but we also have a very large percentage of the population that lives in poverty, and the idea is to make lawyers, lawyer talents available for poor people on legal issues that impact especially on the poor, and those tend to be legal issues relating to housing, immigration issues, public benefits, family law issues, and those are the sort of the main areas where services are provided.
Yeah. One of the projects of the Volunteers involves mothers who are incarcerated. What inspired you to establish that program? Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I've had a long time interest in prison issues. When you're a lawyer, you really, although this is not true of many lawyers, but when you're a lawyer, you really should be aware of prison issues because prisons make up a huge part of our society. And lawyers play many roles in connection with the criminal, obviously with the criminal justice system. We are a country with about 2.3 million people who are incarcerated in our prisons and jails. Before the Soviet Union collapsed and before apartheid ended in South Africa, the United States was the third largest country in terms of imprisoning people in its population. But with the collapse of the Soviet Union and apartheid, we are now the major country in the world in terms of incarceration. Mm. Mothers are of particular interest because mothers are where there are where there are mothers, there are often young children who are can be cast adrift when the mother is incarcerated. And so our project seeks to do at Rikers Island, which is the New York City's main jail, where there are about 1,200 mothers incarcerated, and then at two state prisons, we work with mothers to advise them as to their legal rights and responsibilities as to the custody of their children, as well as their rights and responsibilities as to visits from their children.
Yeah. Can you tell us a story about an individual mother and how she has benefited, what difference this has made in her life?
Well, this is this particular, you know, it's in a sense because these are large, huge systems, often what the lawyers do will actually, on the retelling, seem rather small. But so often, mothers do not know what has happened to their children.
Mm.
And so lawyers can play a useful role in just locating the child.
That's huge.
Well, it is huge, but, you know, for a lawyer, it seems small, but in the life of the family, it's huge. We try to when a mother is incarcerated, the child will either go into the foster care system, which means that they're under some sort of governmental supervision, or they will be taken care of by members of the family, which is an informal arrangement. And sometimes the family does not want to bring the children to the institution, and for various reasons. And so the lawyers try to persuade the members of the family that this is something that they should do. And if the families persist in not bringing the children, then it's necessary for us to go into family court and get a court order.
Mm.
But one of the things that anyone in the prison field will tell you that maintaining family ties is these are really very much lifelines, both for the mother and the children.
Yeah, and you don't have to think about it too long before you realize that this really benefits the larger community as well, because...
Well, it does. It, yeah. It does, A, because the children are in the larger community, and B, that at some point in time, the mothers will be released from the institution.
Yeah.
In terms of Rikers, it may be just a matter of months. In terms of state prisons, it may be a longer period.
Yeah. I suspect this can be challenging work, but I suspect it has its rewards for the volunteers. What are the challenges? What are the rewards?
Well, I think I sometimes think that in our work, I like to think that occasionally we're helping poor people. But I know that we're very much informing and widening the horizons of our volunteer lawyers. For many of the lawyers in this particular project, they have had no contact with prisons or jails or prisoners. And I think, from my own perspective, that this is a very useful thing for lawyers to be aware of, as I mentioned, just because of the scale of penal institutions in this country. And the challenging work can be that often there are many blind alleys in terms of the mothers may often not have very much information about their children. And so it takes a lot of digging and a lot of false leads to follow up on these issues.
Yeah. We've been talking here a little bit about, or quite a bit, about children, and the VALS, the Volunteers of Legal Service, also has two projects involving children, the hospital project and the school project. You want to talk briefly about those?
Yes. Let's just talk about children generally.
Okay.
Because the nature of our work, we depend solely on volunteer lawyers in our projects. And the staff of Volunteers of Legal Service, you're talking to one-third of the professional staff of Volunteers of Legal Service. Mm. So we're a very small organization, but what makes us very effective is that we have about 600 volunteer lawyers who are participating in our projects. And lawyers tend to be very drawn to projects involving children for many obvious reasons. So in our hospital-based project, we are working with seven of the great hospitals in New York City. And your listeners will certainly recognize the names of these hospitals, such as Bellevue, the Children's Hospital of New York Presbyterian, NYU Medical Center. And the client here is the family of the child who is ill, and the lawyers are working on legal issues that impact on the child's health. Now, to make that understandable, so many children all over the country, not just in New York, suffer from asthma. The doctors do everything they can do with the child in addressing the medical needs, and then the child often returns to a household in New York City where there are all sorts of asthma-triggering conditions like falling plaster, collapsing walls, all sorts of rodents, insect infestation. So the lawyers will deal with the landlord in getting these conditions ameliorated. One of the first cases that we had was a child that needed a kidney transplant. The most likely donor was the child's mother, who was sitting in Bogota, Colombia, with all sorts of immigration issues. So the lawyers arranged for the mother to be brought back to the United States under what is called humanitarian parole, so that she could be examined in terms of donating one of her kidneys mm-hmm. to her child. Yeah. So those are the types of issues. All the legal issues relate in some way to the child's health. And the way it works is that I go to a hospital, let's say the Children's Hospital of New York Presbyterian is one of the great children's hospitals of the world. So I go to them and ask them whether they would be interested in this project, and after assuring them that we would not be bringing malpractice suits against the hospital, they say, yes, yes, we would love to have this project. And then I go to a major law firm, in this case Cravath, Swain & Moore, which is one of the leading firms in the United States, and say, would you be interested in doing this? And then they say yes, and then we... So Cravath, the law firm, is actually matched by us with the hospital, and they have about 30 lawyers that participate in that particular match at New York Presbyterian.
That's a terrific thing you're doing.
I just talk about the school project for a moment?
Well, just for 1 minute, literally.
Yes.
Okay.
One minute, literally.
Yeah.
The issue is the legal issue is addressing legal issues that impact on the child's education. If a family is about to be evicted or deported, the child may have to leave the school. So that's where the lawyers work there.
Yeah. William Dean, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. William Dean, a graduate of Harvard College and Columbia Law School, is the executive director of Volunteers of Legal Service. The organization works to increase pro bono civil legal services to New York City's poor.
Earth and Sky.
An earthquake early warning system is being developed in the U.S. for Southern California. Earth and Sky spoke with Earth scientist Richard Allen of UC Berkeley.
We need to move forward in the U.S. and implement a system before the next earthquake occurs, not after it.
The U.S. Geological Survey estimates a 99% chance of a major earthquake, magnitude 6.7 or higher, striking California within the next 30 years. Allen and colleagues tested a warning method using a network of seismic stations during an earthquake that happened late 2007 in the Bay Area.
So the way that the system worked is it detected the beginning of the earthquake. With just 1, 2, or 3 seconds worth of data, it accurately predicted the distribution of ground shaking from that earthquake. And that would mean that San Francisco and Oakland could have about 10 seconds of warning in a repeat earthquake.
These are just tests, though. Allen said the U.S. doesn't yet have a way to warn the public of a coming earthquake.
What I mean by that is that we have a system in place that brings the data in real time from the seismometers to processing centers at UC Berkeley and at the USGS, but we have no system in place to then pass that information on to anybody.
Allen recommends upgrading and expanding the nearly 300 seismic stations in California closer to Japan's system of about 1,000 stations. We're Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.